Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Stick around, because this week Charlotte has sat down with former Wall Street trader turned world-famous photographer David Yarrow, who is an absolutely fascinating Glaswegian with some very interesting perspectives, which you can hear all about a little later on.
Yeah, I think this was one of my favorite interviews ever, actually. Maybe my favorite podcast interview that we've done so far. Yarrow's quite an interesting guy, and he was refreshingly candid when it came to talking about the commercialism of his work, just sort of how much he thinks about what's going to sell when he's choosing what to photograph and how much it guides him, and also to the extent to which he feels he has to be a kind of massive self-publicist. It's interesting to hear people talking about that, I think. And normally with artists, you feel like it's quite brushed under the carpet. But he basically said, look, I sell myself and promote myself all the time, and I definitely think about if what I'm shooting is going to sell in the places where I want to sell it. But he also said some really interesting things about his father's career in shipbuilding. He was working up in Glasgow, where they grew up, which sounds quite tough, actually. And by contrast, he was then name-dropping a few Hollywood celebs that he works with very closely today. So it's a very different world, really, but it was interesting. And always interesting, I find, to hear who people are working with and mixing with. Certainly, he mixes with a very diverse and dynamic crowd.
So I guess one of the reasons we were talking, or rather you were talking to David Yarrow, is because he's very well known for selling his photography to superyacht owners. So I see his photos on superyachts all the time, and there are a couple that always stick out. There's a very famous shot of a monkey whose head is just appearing above water, and a lion. There's a lion kind of stalking towards the camera. And the way, they're black and white photos, but they are just absolutely fantastic pieces of art, really. And yeah, I think if he would be certainly one of my photographers of choice if I was looking to decorate the walls of my yacht.
Yeah, I read in my research that he has a special technique for trying to get that close to wild animals, involving kind of putting out different scents to attract different animals and masking his presence. But he also shoots a lot of supermodels, so it's quite diverse.
Wonder if he uses the same tactic.
I know, I was thinking, I don't know what would lure in the Victoria's Secret crowd, but yeah, he manages to get close to them too.
Well, that is a fantastic interview, so do hang around. We've got a few plugs. Let's get the plugs out the way. I just wanted to talk about our Superyacht Design Festival once again. So I spent this morning with one of our speakers, the owner of 80-meter Nobbeskruk Superyacht Artifact. His name is Mike Lazaridis. He's just a fascinating bloke. He was obviously one of the main people, if not the main person, behind the invention of the smartphone. So he approached the design of his yacht like an engineer and frankly upended convention to produce what a really avant-garde superyacht, and the first superyacht featuring a DC bus system. So he loved the challenge of building the boat, because his job was high adrenaline, high endurance, high stress. He emphasized that point. So he was worried about, when he retired, just kind of dropping off that kind of emotional cliff, as it were. So he needed something to give him a slightly softer landing. So kind of inventing the future with his new yacht provided that, because he was, you know, intimately involved with, you know, everything that, all the technology on board, all the engineering. So the length of the boat, 80 meters, is entirely dictated by the engineering space that's required by such an advanced vessel. So it started out as 50 or 60 meters and just kept growing as the technology kept improving on the boat. But he said, so the living spaces actually haven't changed in volume terms that much since the boat was originally a 50 meter. It's just that to cram on all the stuff he wanted required it to be an 80-meter platform. Anyway, obviously that came with a premium. It cost a lot more than a more conventional 80-meter yacht, but he reckons he'll more than make up for that extra cost in lower running costs, lower maintenance, etc., as the years tick by. But he is, I mean, take it from me, he is just an absolutely fascinating individual who's, you know, not... whose knowledge is profound of subjects of which I have no idea. So I kind of sat there looking blankly at him a few times, But yeah.
I'm really looking forward to hearing him speak, just because that boat, kind of in design terms, there's been so much buzz around it, and he's absolutely set out what he aimed to achieve in creating something different and something that stands out in the landscape. Like, I'm not sure I quite get on board with the idea of taking on a stressful yacht build as a way to enjoy your retirement. I think I'd be happy to hop onto a ready-made one in the Caribbean. But yeah, for sure. Wasn't he the CEO of BlackBerry before? He's got an interesting CV.
Yeah, amazing CV. Amazing CV. He just approaches everything from a really interesting point of view. And I think it requires a mind like his to really push the game on in technology terms on superyacht. So, I mean, but others will trail in his wake. And he was kind of reeling off the names of these almost, household names of tech titans who went to visit the boat in build to see what he was doing. And so we'll see as the years go by, more and more of superyachts coming out with systems that he basically invented for this boat. So, I'm arguing with the events team at the moment to try and give us more time on stage with Mike, because the traditional kind of 30 to 40 minute session just isn't nearly enough to cover everything that he's got to say. And if you come along, you will leave that session richer for it. I can guarantee that. Book your tickets now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Explore Yacht Summit quickly. So that's in Monaco next week. A few tickets are still available. And there's another fascinating owner. The reason I bring this up, because there's another really interesting guy who'll be there. And he is Hans-Jörg Nader, who is the owner, not only the owner of Baltic Yachts. He also built the sailing yacht Pink Gin. He's got a new cafe racer that he was out in Saint-Tropez with recently. He owns the Diamond support vessel Pink Shadow. And he's also revealing another very special project he has in the works at the Explore Yacht Summit. So again, he'll be on the stage. I'll be having a conversation with him. Come along and find out what he's got to say. Can we bear one last plug?
Yeah, go on, cram it in there.
One last plug. But it's not for us this time. This is for one of our owners club members, a chap called Cameron Riddell, who owns this beautiful classic sailing yacht called Eros. He has started a YouTube video series about the yacht. So, because he was inspired by a couple of other sailors who have massive followings on YouTube, and I think make quite good money out of them, just charting their lives on board, either sailing around the world or doing various other exciting things. So the YouTube channel he started is called Sailing Eros, and he's done three videos so far. Each one is about 15 minutes long, and it's just a really nice insight into what it's like to own and run a yacht first delivered in 1939. So we'll put a link to that in the description. And there's also a story on our website now. But if you want to shortcut all that, just go to YouTube, type in Sailing Eros, and you can find the first couple of episodes up there. But it's great. Enjoy. Quite a dramatic first episode. The main mast snaps.
Nice.
Yeah, so it requires quite a hefty repair. But yeah, I mean, the kind of stuff like that you just don't hear.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to see. At the moment, I've been seeing loads of stuff on TikTok, kind of little tiny clips of crew on doing kind of below deck type videos. And yeah, they serve a purpose and they're interesting. But it's nice to see the other kind of side of the coin and see some longer videos and see how owners are spending their time to get a more realistic picture of it, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. The crew have taken over TikTok.
Yeah, exactly. We need more owners on the internet.
Anyway, enough plugging. Charlotte. You've been working on some very special features.
I have. Well, they're always very special. I think you'll find. But this one in particular is always very anticipated. So it's a big feature that we run every January called the Top 101. And this is our kind of ultimate rundown, basically, of the biggest boats in the world, including all the exciting new launches, all the kind of ones that are just on the horizon and where they're at. Now, I have to say, it's not an easy one to pull together, because the shipyards are notoriously tight-lipped when it comes to releasing the details of major projects before they're ready to do so. But our writer Sam has done a sterling job of wrangling as much information as possible out of people and using a vast network of boat spies to give you as much of the picture as you can.
So which of this year's new entries? I think there's five, isn't there? There's five new entries to the Top 101 list.
I think so.
Five or six.
You're testing me. It's around that.
I think it's around that. So what was your favourite?
Well, the one I'm really looking forward to learning more about is the 140-metre Lloyd Werft Solaris. And I'm interested in her particularly because she's been designed by Mark Newson. So pretty much a household name. But if you've not heard of him, he was the guy behind the Apple Watch, and he worked for some time at Apple. And he also did stints at other really iconic brands like Alessi and Philippe Starck. And he's just one of those iconic designers that has a real style and seems to make everything they touch look really cool. But I'm also interested kind of in a perverse way, because prior to this project, his only nautical project was a 10-meter Aquariva. So he started small and then leapt to something massive. But I'm sure it'll be really interesting. The information Samaj gets said that the broad arch that encases the white overhangs of the superstructure is sure to become an iconic feature, making the yacht instantly recognizable. So very, very much looking forward to seeing what that looks like, really.
Yeah, that arch, I mean, just from the images we've seen, I mean, there's lots of photos now of Solaris out there, but not a lot of information to go with them. But that arch, yeah, is pretty much the defining feature of that boat, long aft deck to lots of outside space. I mean, fingers crossed, I'm praying we get the opportunity to feature that boat and also have it in the awards programs, because I know the judges would love to, World Super Awards judges would love to have a look at it and, you know, discover some of the inspiration behind the design choices that the owner made. So, yeah, a fascinating boat.
So a not so subtle hint to Mark Newson there. If you're listening, Mark, if you're out there, let us on.
Well, hopefully we're working with the owner's team to try and get her into the program. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, so definitely looking forward to that. And there was one other boat. I mean, there were lots of interesting ones in there, but the other one that caught my eye was this 116-meter Lursen called Project Enzo. For two reasons. Largely, firstly, it has an 80-square-meter gym on the top deck, which I thought was quite unusual. We did a piece a while back talking about how, you know, you used to find some quite sad dumbbells chucked in the very bowels of the boat, and now gyms are sort of taking center stage for owners who are interested in that kind of thing. And apparently this was a very deliberate design decision to emphasize the role of the gym and to make it more prominent and to avoid hiding it away. So I thought that was unusual. But something more close to my heart, I would say, is that the owner, who's an American, clearly has a bit more of a sense of balance, because the dining area also has this amazing wine display. It's a kind of statement design thing. And Dan Leonard, who designed it, said even without bottles, it's really beautiful. So, yeah, I know which area I'd probably find myself spending more time in. But interesting to see some kind of statement areas on that boat.
There's another very, very special boat, a little bit smaller, and you've been talking with the owner of recently, and that's coming up in the magazine. And we might have referenced it in a previous podcast, but it was a very famous boat once owned by Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mentioned it before. I've been sort of gradually tracking down all the people involved in the story. So I had a great chat with the owner, and I think I filled everyone on the podcast about that. But I had a sort of equally interesting chat with a guy called Ashim last week, who basically project managed. He owns a company in Bombay that does super yacht refits and along with other things. But he managed this big refit on the recent Kalisma and the former one under her former owner, Vijay, which happened back in 2006. But the main thing I found interesting about it is he was talking about trying to get her back into class, because she wasn't in class when they bought her. They bought her at auction, and no one wanted to touch her. She had two insurance claims against her, including one from the day before the auction when a Chinese trawler had just steamed straight into her. So she was a real mess. But it just made me realise, we're obviously very focused on new yachts, but basically the kind of rules that apply to all these new builds really aren't that applicable to boats built hundreds of years ago. He was saying they kept doing all these stability tests where they were adding more and more and more ballast to the boat, and they kept taking it to different parts of the world, getting it tested, getting it denied, back to the drawing board over and over and over again. He sounds like one of the most patient people I've ever heard talking about it. They even took the jacuzzi off, which was something they were going to do anyway. But, you know, they made really significant strides to try and get this to a point where they could get it back into class, and really struggled with it. And I think eventually they reached this point where they said, look, there's nothing else we can do here. This is the way the boat's built. You know, take it or leave it type thing. And thankfully she did get back in class, which is obviously great. Made a huge difference to their insurance apart from anything else. But it did make me realise, you know, you can't necessarily apply all these new standards to boats that just weren't built with that in mind, I guess.
What a saga.
Yeah, exactly. He seemed very glad to have come out the other side of it. And now it means it will get loads of charter bookings. I'm sure it's already getting booked up if they can keep the owner off it himself, who seems to be enjoying it perfectly.
Actually, in another conversation I had with him, he was telling me that he reckons Sri Lanka is the next up and coming. There's not a lot of services and infrastructure there at the moment, but he reckons Sri Lanka is the next great undiscovered super yacht destination.
Yeah.
So I think they're building a big new marina in Galle, I think.
Well, I think he's kind of on the money because he was one of the first people to invest in Dubai when there was very little there. He bought a kind of handful of azimuts there when they were first coming to Dubai because he saw the potential there. And yeah, talking to him about that, you thought, God, yeah, that area, since 2002 when he invested in it, it's just exploded in popularity, and with it kind of more super yachts, more infrastructure for yachts and that sort of thing. So he's definitely kind of, you know, if anybody knows about it, I wouldn't be surprised if it was him.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlotte. Some great features in the works there. I can't wait to see them in the magazine and online. All right, let's get on with this week's news. And we start with the news that there is a new Viking 90. It was unveiled at the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show and they have already sold 10 of them. Unbelievable. Wow. Yeah, there will be three versions, an open bridge and a closed bridge and a sky bridge. All will have space for 5 cabins and a full beam owner's cabin. So the 90 goes into production on May the 1st next year. The first one will be at the Miami Boat Show in 2023. And while we're talking about flibs, Cecile, who is our executive editor out in the States, obviously was there with the rest of the editorial team from Fort Lauderdale. We couldn't get there, sadly, because we were still banned. But that's being lifted, thankfully, very, very soon. But so she sent over some other insights from the show. She said it was really, really busy. And like Monaco, the feedback from exhibitors was there were lots of qualified people there. So lots of buyers, loads of boats being sold at the show. Nordhavn got 5 letters of intent, which is amazing. And Viking, because we're talking about Viking, is having the best year it's had in its history. How about that? One other insight she sent over that I thought was really interesting, and I heard this at Monaco as well. A lot of the yards are saying that they're, despite all these boats are being sold, look, it's been an amazing brokerage year, obviously. The order book's full. The global order book is being compiled right now, and that's got some really amazing top line numbers. All will be revealed soon. But despite all the activity, margins are being squeezed because raw material prices are going up. And so there's not a lot of passing on of that cost to the customer. So despite groaning order books, margins are getting even slimmer in an already slim margin kind of business. So it's just something.
And why are they not pushing their prices up? Because they're worried about them losing out to other builders, other.
Yeah, I mean, quite. I think it's just a super competitive space. I think really we're talking about the kind of slightly more semi-custom and production end of the market.
Yeah.
But in those size ranges, it's the competition is fierce. And despite lots of boats being sold, it's quite a thing just to pass on a hefty chunk of inflation onto the end user. So, you know, obviously there's a bit of it, but despite all this great news we're hearing, it is interesting to hear, well, you know, it is great, but, you know, we're not making the same kind of margins we were 12 or 18 months ago on each individual unit sold. So that's quite interesting.
Well, she did. Yeah, you're right. I had a video call with Cecile maybe a day after flibs and she looked quite pale. she did look quite pale. She said it was so busy that people were almost kind of falling off the docks and into the water because it was heaving. So someone's got to be making some money out of that somewhere is happening. But in other news, CRN have sold a 67-metre project and the buyer was introduced by Moran. It's going to be built in steel and aluminium. And the new yacht comes from the board of On Fire Studio, Nuvolari Leonard, who are doing amazingly at the moment. It will be built with a diesel electric propulsion system. And that's pretty much all we know at present. But obviously great news for CRN to score this really important new project.
It's got those kind of classic Nuvolari Leonard kind of sweeping down to the waterline lines. There is a graphic on the website now, so have a look at that. Staying in Italy, Cantiere Delle Marche has announced the sale of its third Flexplorer model. The Flexplorer 146 has been commissioned by a Swiss owner with what the shipyard says is an unbound passion for big game fishing. Exterior lines have come from the boards of Sergio Cotullo and the Hydrotech Studio, with understated interiors imagined by Nauta. Unlike its sister ships, this is interesting, the 146 will not carry an A-frame on the aft deck. Obviously, if you're familiar with the World Superyacht Award-winning Cantieri Delle Marche Aurelia, which we featured on the cover of the US edition not too long ago, so it's got this massive A-frame on the back, which hides away really well. Basically, it's enormously handy for lifting heavy equipment like tenders and subs or whatever you want on your aft deck. But on this latest 146, the area will be reserved for an immense social space equipped with sunbeds. The shipyard also promises the new model to feature fresh ideas and pioneering applications of innovative features. So there you go. Again, all stories on the website.
I was going to say, that's becoming a bit of a Nauta trademark, this kind of amazing beach club or sort of big outdoor space. We're talking about that, the design festival, how they've kind of been some of the people to move this expansive beach club area, or just generally kind of big social spaces out on deck. Not surprised to see that going on there.
They're really good now to that kind of, you know, calm, nature-inspired interior, exterior kind of flow. Mm. Geniuses at that. All right, the data story this month concerns, appropriately, given next week is the Explore Yachts Summit, Explore Yachts. Charlotte.
We are. So I'll kick us off. There are currently 727 Explore Yachts, but that figure includes projects that are under construction. The average LOA is 40.15, which is up from 38.15 in 2019. So creeping up there. Combined, they make up a total LOA of 25,134 metres. And the largest one under construction, one that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, is the 182.90 metre Rev. As some of you know, she's had some delays, so is still under construction, still on the horizon, with a slightly later launch than planned. And along with her, there are currently 81 other Explorer yachts in build. Some of them will be emerging soon, obviously, but we thought we'd maybe take a look at the top five largest active Explorer yachts that are out there at the moment exploring.
Should we count down from
top of the pops? Do you want to go for five?
In at five, we have Le Grand Bleu, which at is 112.8 meters long, with carries a volume of 5,496 gross tons. It has five decks. It's built in steel and was built in Germany by Bremer Vulcan and delivered in the year 2000.
Number four is Luna. It's 115 metres long with a gross tonnage of 5,655. She's got six decks, is made from steel, aluminium and teak, was built by Lloyd Werft and was delivered back in 2010.
Luna is one of my all-time faves.
Really? Why?
Just because I had a really good look around her a few years ago in Gibraltar and I wrote the story for the magazine. But the one kind of slight sadness about her is that she is just this most hugely capable boat, but she actually hasn't done that much exploring, mm-hmm. considering her amazing abilities. She's been a bit over to the States. I seem to remember she spent time in the Great Lakes. I think that's right. Please write if I'm right in if I'm wrong. But she's kind of built for the high latitudes and, you know, things like the Northwest Passage and all sorts of cool stuff. But I think that's still to come in her
it's
story.
A shame, yeah.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
It's obviously not been the best couple of years for people getting out there anyway, but
yeah.
Hopefully now.
At three, we have the Cleven Ulysses, 116.15 metres long, 6,862 gross tonnes, five decks, steel and aluminium, delivered in 2018. This is obviously the second Ulysses, or rather, I mean, he's had a ton of Ulysses boats, Graham Hart, who is a very wealthy New Zealander. So he built the first Ulysses, which is, I think, it's 107 metres, which is now called Andromeda. And then whilst that was being built, he commissioned the second longer one at 116.15 metres. And I have been on the first one, which is now Andromeda, but I've not been on the second one. But the first one was awesome.
Really?
Just awesome. I mean, there's really no other adjective for it.
Well, I've only just realised as we're going through this, I now don't get to read number one, which I realised as we got to number three, I feel slightly hard done by. But I have got a good one for number two. Very, very famous boat is Octopus. It's 126.20 metres LOA, gross tons of 9,932, six stacks made from steel, aluminium, and teak, and built by Lursen. And she was delivered back in 2003 and has a very famous owner,
Had a very famous owner. Paul Allen obviously commissioned Octopus. A very young Espinoino, as well as Jonathan Quinn Barnett, worked on this boat way back in the early 2000s. Again, this is one I snuck aboard a few years ago as well and had a really good tour. And if Ulysses was awesome, the adjective you'd have to ascribe to Octopus is epic.
More awesome.
Yeah, I mean, amazing boat. And I think I've wanged on about it on this podcast before, but basically it's a huge boat. But it doesn't feel, once you're in the living spaces, it doesn't feel overwhelming or huge. They're really well-designed interior spaces, very comfortable. Obviously, that doesn't quite apply to the aft end of the boat, which has this enormous floodable garage. I mean, that is just epic in scale. So this big, you know, yellow submarine floats out, this huge tender as well. Or chase boat, it's not a tender, it's a full-on chase boat, it's massive. That's recently been sold, Octopus, and the new owner's been cruising around the Med. She's for charter, excitingly, for the first time ever.
Well, there you go. You can announce number one. It's another Lloyd Werft, meaning they have two of the top five.
Lloyd Werft in the game. Good work. And it's a boat we've already mentioned in the podcast. It is Solaris. She is the largest active explorer out there currently. So she's 139.7 meters, 11,247 gross tons, seven decks, steel and aluminium again. Lloyd Werft. Delivered just this year.
Seven decks? Yeah. That's massive. That's a skyscraper of a boat.
Yeah. She's a big unit. Yeah. But she's 140 meters, so she's got plenty of length to carry them. Mm. So, yeah, fingers crossed. Again, that's one I hope to sneak aboard at some point in the not too distant future. And that brings us to the end of news and data for this week. I hope you enjoyed that. Stick around for Charlotte's interview with world famous photographer David Yarrow.
So today I'm joined by fine art photographer David Yarrow. I'm sure most of you will recognise his name. David's pieces are highly sought after by yacht owners around the world and command a premium for those lucky enough to get their hands on them. If you don't recognise his name, you'll almost certainly recognise his striking black and white photography as soon as you see it. He's captured everything from portraits of Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, who himself famously owned the superyacht Nadine, of course, to supermodels like Cindy Crawford and Cara Delevingne, as well as some incredible shots of wildlife up close. So firstly, David, thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you. So I thought we'd start, obviously being a superyacht podcast, before going on to talk about your work, by talking with your kind of yachting connections and your background. So I know that your father, Eric Yarrow, was actually a member of the Yarrow shipbuilding dynasty before he went on to work at Clydesdale Bank. So I just wondered kind of how aware were you as a child and sort of how involved were you in that?
We often laugh at the word dynasty because when I think of dynasty, I think of the series based in Denver with Joan Collins and it was a massive family empire.
Conjures up a different image.
This was no dynasty, I can assure you. This was tough work on what was called the Red Tide in Glasgow. And my great-grandfather set it up and moved from the Isle of Dogs up to Scotstoun at the turn of the century, thus 120 years ago. And then my grandfather ran it and my father ran it. We supplied principally frigates to the British Royal Navy, but also to a lot of navies around the world. My dad was nothing if not a salesman, and he managed to persuade sort of landlocked countries to buy military ships, which I think is quite an achievement. But it was the glory days of shipbuilding on the Clyde in Glasgow have long since gone. But Yarrow still exists, albeit part of BAE, British Aerospace, BAE Systems. And I remember going to launches in the 70s very well. And we always used to have either the current prime minister come up and launch one of the frigates or potentially a member of the royal family. I also remember during the Falkland War in 1982, I think we lost two frigates within the space of 48 hours to the Argentinians. So there was bittersweet moments to it. It was not a, these were not luxury recreational vessels. These were big, fast frigates. And then most of them had names beginning with A or B. Like Broadsword had a very good Falklands, was considered, at the time of the Exocets, was considered a first-class frigate.
And how interested in it were you? Was it just, you know, what your family was working on and it didn't particularly inspire you, or were you quite drawn to what they were doing and the stories that they told?
I think, first and foremostly, shipbuilding on the Clyde, it was difficult to be brought up in Glasgow and not think about shipbuilding on the Clyde, because it was an integral part of the city.
Yeah.
And also in a city that's 50% Protestant, 50% Catholic, almost everyone that worked on the Clyde was Protestant, not because the management wanted it, it's what the unions wanted, in the same way that most people that worked down the mines were Catholic. And that, in turn, played into football and Celtic and Rangers, because, of course, Celtic was Catholic and Rangers was Protestant and Rangers was right by the Clyde. So the whole thing was interlinked. I found the whole concept, and you see it when on the recent documentary with Sir Alec Ferguson, who started life on the Clyde, and Billy Connolly, who started life on the Clyde. It's very rare that you have Glaswegians that haven't been touched by the story of shipbuilding. It was a fairly miserable way to make money. It would be not the case that this was a way to for great riches. My father, who passed away recently, lived in a fairly modest house, and this was not a road to having a mansion in Los Angeles or something like that. It was, I think, public service, and you felt a huge sense of pride with the craftsmen of the Clyde when those ships would be launched, often in front of, you know, many thousands of people.
Yeah,
my dad was a man of the people, which I really respected. He would treat someone from the British Admiralty in exactly the same way that he'd treat a shop steward or a junior boilermaker. He was very keen to get out and about and talk to people that were doing nasty work in a tough industry. You know, Glasgow in January and February is a fairly miserable place to be. It's an even more miserable place to be if you're halfway up a boat outside on the Clyde painting it.
Yeah, for sure.
So it was a tough place for tough people. There used to be 62 shipyards on the Clyde, and I think there's now two.
Yeah.
And they used to employ, I think the number was around about 200,000 people. And they used to say that for every person that was employed in the Clyde, there'd be two people supplying the people that worked on the Clyde. So it was a 600,000 industry. And now there's just two yards left.
Yeah, it's incredible how it's gone from kind of all consuming to what it is today. Yeah.
But you could say exactly the same of also Liverpool. You could say the same on Tyneside, Teesside. You look at and also Belfast. So Barrow and Furness, so all the areas that used to be associated with heavy shipbuilding in Britain, it's the same story.
Yeah. And you say your dad could, you know, sell ice to the Eskimos. Do you feel like you've inherited any of that that trait yourself, or was that very specific to him?
Well, of course, you can't call them Eskimos any longer because we live in a woke culture. So I'd say I can sell ice to the Inuit.
Okay.
Ice to the Inuits. I think everyone in 2021, irrespective of what you do, has to embrace a sales culture. Whether you're the Prime Minister, he has to sell to people. Whether you are Cristiano Ronaldo, he still has to sell to people. It doesn't really matter what you do, if unless you are making no effort to engage with the outside world. You have to start every day thinking about how you can engage with other people and sell yourself to other people, whether it's a product or yourself. I think Prince William's a salesman, and a very good one, I think.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. But yeah, I think that some people it comes more naturally than others, perhaps.
I think I'm blessed by the fact that the people that I meet are far more interesting than me. So if I can be around the table with some certain people that I was in Austin 2 days ago, and I had an American footballer on one side of me, a guy that's just doing a movie for Apple in New Orleans on the other side, and a venture cap billionaire. Well, it's quite easy to show interest in those people because I am interested.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you count super yacht owners in that demographic, or are they less interesting than a lot of the people that you are selling to?
I think there's very few people that are touched with privilege that aren't interesting, because most of them have probably made the money. There'll be some that haven't.
Yeah, for sure.
There'll be some that will have squandered it, what has been inherited to them. But the majority of people that we have dealt with that have big boats, like I was at the Monaco Boat Show, and I know it's coming around again soon, but and I think there's a couple of big boats we've had where there's 40 or 50 pieces of our work throughout the boat. But they're going to be fascinating people. With also huge attention to detail, which I like, because I think I've got that attention to detail as well.
It's interesting. So I wondered, are you able to name any big boats? I know that Benetti's Triumph is one that's kind of in the public domain and that's just been sold. So I don't know what's happening to those pieces, but are you able to name any of the others, or is it all kind of under wraps, agreements, all that sort of thing?
Well, I don't think it's any secret that our gallery that represents us in Monaco, right by Sass Cafe, is owned by Tina Green, Lady Green's boat. And I think Lionheart, the tenders have my lion images on the side. And I'm very, very fond of Tina. And she runs an excellent gallery in Monaco.
She's written for us for some time, actually.
It's rather funny that someone that wrongly some people think doesn't have to get out of bed in the morning, she actually is a big worker, and I really respect that.
And I wanted to ask, because, you know, lots of this, when I'm looking at your work, you know, you have these sort of, for example, the Jordan Belfort picture, you'd think, oh, well, you would, you know, people might rightly or wrongly assume that that's the kind of thing a yacht owner might go for, in that it's, you know, capitalist and quite extravagant and indulgence and that kind of thing. Do you tend to find that the yacht owners you sell to gravitate towards one kind of work, or is it completely polarized? Is there anything that they have in common from your perspective?
It's a good question. And we do, I'm in Dallas at the moment, and obviously pictures of cowboys sell quite well in Dallas, Texas. If someone's got a boat, his nationality, I had no idea what his nationality will be, but if he's an American, my Americana series might sell quite well. We've spent a lot of time in East Africa, and maybe too much time, really, over the last 3 or 4 years, and I haven't been there for quite a while, and I won't be going back for quite a while. I can understand why. If you take the picture you just described of my ode to that wonderful scene in the Scorsese movie, of the boat scene with the FBI, all other things being equal, irrespective of its largesse and irrespective of its seemingly gratuitous use of women, it's a parody. It's art. So, and of course, in this era of wokeness, we walk on shells, but it's art. I'm making fun of myself in the same way that Scorsese was making fun of the book. You've got to suspect something like that's going to sell better on a boat than a picture of an elephant in Africa.
Yeah.
I think the biggest problem with boats is that my pictures are big. Luckily, the biggest boats I ever see anywhere in the world are in Monaco. But
I was going to say that the boats are getting bigger and bigger, so you're in luck.
And the other thing is that the light in boats, you've got to position them in the right place. But I'm in awe of a lot of the interior designers that work with with the yacht manufacturers. And yes, I think I'm not sure the number we've got. I'd imagine we've probably got 200 pictures in luxury boats around the world, I guess.
But I'd say that's a really significant number given how few yachts of this type there are, you know, and especially ones with owners who are interested in photography. It's a fairly narrow pool of people, I would say. Do you think there's any reason why your work resonates with them in particular? Because, you know, certain photographers and artists are always trying to break through to this section of people, and you're one of those people that's been very successful in doing that.
Well, you flatter me a little bit. I mean, I you know, 80% of the work that has been sold of mine around the world, about 80%, I've somehow or other met the people that have bought it.
Mm-hmm. Directly rather than through agencies and things?
No, through galleries, but I'd still meet them. If I was to spend quite a lot of money on a piece of art, if the artist was alive, I'd like to meet the artist. That's what half of my job is, meeting people. So when I go to Monaco in 10 days time, it's not like I'm going to be lying by the pool. I wish I could lie by the pool. I'm just going to be going out and about meeting people.
And what's your, of all the images that you capture, what are your favorite things? What do you really enjoy doing? And does that necessarily tally with what the demand is for?
Well, if I photographed things that there were no demand for, we wouldn't be having this conversation because I'd be out of business. let's imagine that I really enjoyed photographing rats in sewers. Well, I don't think anyone wants a picture of a rat in a sewer. So I'm very conscious of what sells and what doesn't sell. We have a thing called Komodo Gate. And Komodo Gate basically is, you know, those dragons that live in Indonesia on the island of...
Yeah, in Bali.
Yeah, not far from there. So if my team sat on that beach and we got a definitive picture of the lizard walking towards me, and I came back to our boat overnight and said, yeah, cigar time, we've got the picture, it's immersive, it's in focus, it's a big Komodo dragon, someone might say, well, great, David, but who the hell is going to buy that picture? Why would someone want that picture? So we call that Komodo Gate because it addresses the fact that authenticity without commerciality is an own goal. You have to have authenticity and also commerciality. And that cuts down the number of ideas that have both those criteria significantly. But we shot the Cindy Crawford Pepsi commercial, famous one from 1992, two weeks ago, with her, she hasn't changed, with the same hairstylist, same team, same location. And there was no issue with regard to the commerciality. We knew that if we got it right, it's going to be commercial. The only issue was the authenticity. But within a still frame, trying to incorporate the narrative of that 90-second video advert, great advert, into one frame was a challenge, but it's authentic because I don't think it's been done before. So that was something where we went out and we knew it was going to have both authenticity and commerciality, if I got it right.
I know that you came from a commercial background previously rather than a kind of more traditional, artistic path. Do you think that sort of makes you more relatable to superyacht owners? Do you think that you feel like you all speak the same language or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, I worked in Wall Street ran hedge funds for 15, 17 years. So I've got my war wounds. I find that community is much more humane and emotionally intelligent than the press makes them out to be. And so there's that, my time there has afforded a degree of empathy. I'm still UBS's ambassador. It's quite funny, I think UBS have two global ambassadors, the world's best driver, i.e. Lewis Hamilton, and the world's worst driver, which is me. So they actually managed to combine. I think because I've worked in that pressurized world, I understand it, I understand the pressures that they go through. And the fact that it might, on the outside, a life of privilege, But it's a life of intense pressure as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So I can always, I don't really, if you meet someone that's a prospective customer, I find it very uncomfortable if the conversation for 20 minutes is all about what I do. I'd much rather have a conversation which is split 50-50 in terms of what they do. If they were a heart surgeon, I'd struggle on my 10 minutes because I don't know an awful lot about heart surgery. But if they're involved in trading and in markets or day-to-day business, then it's an easier conversation.
And when you made that move from Wall Street into photography, because I know that the two were kind of running concurrently for a while, was there a kind of, obviously it had been in the back of your mind, but was there a sort of trigger point or not a light bulb moment, but was there something that kind of clicked that made you think, you know what, actually, I really want to do this full time now?
Clearly, this might not be the first time I've been asked this question, and it's the right question. There was always in my mind that I wanted to do it, but that's going to be interfaced with, can I afford to do it? So if you change careers and you've got one train that's moving, albeit slowly, and I didn't feel it was my passion, but it's providing for a family. And then you say, you know, to hell with it, I'm going to go and do something totally different and jump onto a train that's stationary. That's quite a challenging thing to do. So I made sure that the other train was starting to move. But the point at which I crossed from one train to the other was entirely based on one photograph, which I took in South Sudan in 2013, just after Christmas. And it was a picture called Mankind. And I thought that if I wasn't to make the move then I never would. And it was quite cathartic to have that process. I went to America, I showed it to some art advisors who were enthusiastic, and I sold my business virtually the next day, and it was the right thing to do. I knew that to get from there to where I'm fortunate enough to be now, the one thing that had to be constant was total commitment. And I was lucky in that I'm very blessed with my two children, my ex-wife that I get on very well with. I was single at that time, and if I'd been married with your kind of green Volvo and brown Labrador in the Cotswolds, I couldn't have really done what I did, because I had to be fairly single-minded, and I'm not in the UK at all much. I'm either at shows, we've got galleries around the world, or I'm creating new content. So I'm speaking to you in Dallas, I'll be in Zurich tomorrow, I'll then do Soccer Aid in Manchester on Saturday, I'll then be in Monaco, then be in Oslo, then Chicago. So it just goes on. There's not much time to sort of be at home and put my feet up.
I was going to say, I mean, do you like this lifestyle? You know, it sounds like it's kind of similarly high pressure in terms of certainly the travel and the commitments that you have.
I do love it. My kids see a much happier dad. They meet very interesting people through their dad. And when we got a few celeb, you know, when I was working finance, I would never get text messages from Chris Hemsworth or DiCaprio. Now it's actually quite nice. Now it's actually quite nice to your sons go, actually, Dad, you're not a loser. These are quite cool people that are getting in touch with you.
Gets you some cool points, if nothing else.
Yeah, and it's very difficult as a parent to get that.
Yeah, for sure.
And some of the footballers that we meet in the NFL and in America as well, we've got some nice connections. So, no, I enjoy it, and I surround myself, I'm very lucky, I surround myself with people that have been excellent at what they do, and it's quite humbling, because I've got a long way to go to match their achievements, and that's a nice position to be. It's a corollary of, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, get out of the room. And I think with where I am now, I often find myself in rooms where I'm by far and away the least accomplished person in the room. And I'm not saying that self-deprecatingly, it's true. And it's encouraging, it's motivating.
So when do you think the train stops? Do you think there's something that you're aiming for that then you'll feel like, okay, now I've made it, now I can retire happy? Or do you think you'll always have that feeling of needing to achieve more and wanting to do more?
I don't think creatives retire. I think if you work at the post office, and I feel for people that do work at the post office, I can see how you look forward to your retirement. I think if you're a creative, look at some of the great filmmakers of our era. They're still working. Clint Eastwood's just finished a film. He's, what, 92? Martin Scorsese's doing two films at the moment. He's, what, 78? So why would you retire? I'm shit at golf. I don't play bridge.
I was going to ask, what does downtime look like for you? You mentioned football a couple of times. Are you a footy fan?
Yeah, I tend to watch Scotland lose at most sports. last night, I was watching Andy Murray gallantly losing in five sets at the US Open. So I'm a very proud Scot. And it's masochistic. It's masochistic, but I do tend to... Scotland have got a big game tomorrow night, which I can't go out, but I'll be watching through one eye in Zurich. And then family is important, of course, the most important thing. And I think that when I'm very lucky, my son's starting to work for me now, and that's a responsibility and a joy to have your son under your wing. He's far smarter in many ways than me, most ways than me. That's got to be a hobby.
Okay. Well, I won't keep you much longer because I know that you are a busy man and you've got a call straight after this one. But you mentioned you've got your show in Monaco. I know that you've got one in London at the Maddox Gallery as well. Are there any particular, if people are going to these shows, are there any particular pieces that you have interesting anecdotes about or that you think, you know what, people might overlook this one, but it's my personal favourite?
So I think the work that's going to be on show in London and Oslo and Monaco, around the world over the next 6 to 12 months, I think the thing that I'm most proud of is that almost all the pictures were taken during COVID. And there were two ways you could react to COVID. One was to have an attitude of woe is us and it's miserable and I can't work. And I understand that if you worked in the hospitality industry, there's not much you can do about it. You could be the most resourceful person in the hospitality industry, but you were going to be in trouble. But if you're a filmmaker, you just have to be resourceful. And I've had to suck it up a little bit and launder my passport to get into America a few times in Mexico, whatever. But I like the fact that the body of work has all been mostly taken during COVID. I think that there's two or three big pictures there. There's no weak pictures. It's always great to work with Cara Delevingne, and I'm taking her to Antarctica in November, which should be quite interesting. But she can adapt to any role, and we shot up in the where they shot The Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp way back in about 2012 in a place called Creed in Colorado, and I wanted her to be Bonnie, as in Bonnie and Clyde, and Faye Dunaway played Bonnie and Bonnie and Clyde with Warren Beatty many years ago, and I got her to dress as style as that, and she was perfect, and it was incredibly cold, -15, -20, but Cara's a real trooper, and that worked well. I think our strongest picture that I took was of a steam engine. We hired the steam engine because clearly, if I was going to put what I want, outlaws in front of the steam train, the Iron Horse, it couldn't be a working steam train because it'd be passengers. So we had to hire the steam train. And working at 11,000 feet with these enormous amount of steam coming out of the steam engine and very cold horses with a precipice, with a drop of 2,000 feet one side. And there's a picture called the Iron Horse we got, which I'm proud of. It's a photographer's photograph. There's an awful lot of information and context, and it worked. There's something hopelessly romantic about a steam engine as well, even in America when they were often attacked by bad guys. Anything that's defying gravity kind of works. And I would also say that the Cindy Pepsi shot is a good shot. It's a good shot because of her, not because of me. But I'm proud of it. She loves it. And I think all the money's from that picture is to raise money for pediatric cancer. So this is nice.
Ah, brilliant. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, David. We look forward to seeing all these. And I hope to catch up with you again soon.
Charlotte, thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.